You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine. New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hi, I'm Leanne Whitney, guest host working alongside host Jeffrey Mishlove, co-host Emmy Vadnais, and my other colleagues here at New Thinking Aloud. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Thomas More to the show. Thomas More is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Care of the Soul. He has written 30 other books on the depth psychology of everyday life, including most recently Soul Therapy and the Eloquence of Silence. Thomas earned his PhD in religious studies from Syracuse University. He was a university professor for a number of years, but is perhaps best known for his 30-year psychotherapy career. His work brings together spirituality, mythology, depth psychology, and the arts, emphasizing the importance of images and imagination. Today, Thomas and I will be discussing all things soul and soulful, including nature, the arts, and the brilliant work of C.G. Jung. Thomas will be joining me remotely from his home in New Hampshire, and now I will switch over to the internet interview. Thomas More, welcome. Nice to be with you today.
Nice to be with you, Leah.
I am all ready to have a nice discussion on soul. Kind of wish we were sitting in the same room by a fireplace for this conversation. I think it would definitely add the right texture and environment. But I want to say, first of all, there's some words in our culture, mind, consciousness, soul, that different disciplines, different people, everybody has different definitions, really, of these words. There's no general consensus. But when we're looking for the unity of knowledge, it's nice to hear, obviously, from the different perspectives and how different people are touching into that. What would you say, what is your core definition of soul?
Well, I think it depends on the day I'm talking, because I have different interests in mind. But today, I think I have an image rather than a definition. My image is that the soul is like a spring. It's like a spring, like the water coming out of the ground, that kind of a spring, where your life sort of bubbles up or streams out of this place, and you find your life coming up from within you. Or if a person has a soul, or even if an organization has a soul, I think that their life is not something they manufacture constantly, but that it comes up from inside them in a way, or sometimes from outside. And it's very easy then to say, well, that's me. And you don't realize that actually the source of your life is bigger than you. It's bigger than who you are, but at the same time, it is who you are, because it's your source. So I guess if you want a word that would be closest, it would be source or spring.
Yes, and so it's a both and. It's a bigger than, but also exactly, it is who you are. So that's like a non-dual perspective then. Like, there is no ultimate separation. It's a flow. And spring, when I think of spring, a couple things I think of is nature. So it's natural. It's of the natural world. And I also think of flow.
Yes, it's a moving thing. So, I mean, you can get stuck sometimes, but generally speaking, the soul is a movement. You might even call it that. It's a movement in you that you don't control entirely. You can affect it somewhat, but it's the beauty of it is that it's life that's coming through you, and you don't have to own it and control it entirely. You can do it to some extent, but it's I think that's the beauty of the life of soul, is that it's a flow, it's a movement. It's all about life, breathing, and being alive.
So life force, even. Yeah, breath, soul, pneuma.
Well, it makes a difference what word you use. You know, force is very different from a movement. You know, that's a whole different thing. So I think we have to be careful of our use of words, and you can't interchange them too easily. So that's what I've been doing all my career, practically, is trying to find the right language and just to write in a way that evokes what I think the soul is. And it's very fragile, and it's a very specific thing. So I find that it doesn't work to try to say, oh, from another way of thinking that it's this, it's something else. Well, it isn't. All I can say is that as far as I can see, the soul is this kind of a moving, flowing sourcing of life and vitality that keeps us alive, and it's deep-seated, so it gives us a feeling of depth, and which is a word often associated with soul, depth. So it's not the whole thing. It's not the whole story, but it's, I think, part of it.
I love that it's more of a verb to you than a noun. Like, it's not, so it's not something that can really be bound.
No, not really.
Yeah. It's actually beyond a concept, even though we use concepts perhaps to point to things. Concepts are more abstractions. So how would you, in a world that has become, perhaps we could say, more secularized, that there's less people affiliated with particular religious institutions or denominations, what guidance do you give to the generations coming up to tap into or get in touch with this life movement?
Well, you said it a few minutes ago. I am very influenced by the Transcendentalists. I live in New England. I've lived here for 30 years, and I've been reading them for Henry David Thoreau and Emerson and Margaret Fuller and Emily Dickinson in particular. And they were in a situation much like ours. The churches were failing around them, at least the ones that they were connected to. And it was an issue for all of those people. Do you keep going to church or not? And they decided not. And Emerson was a big scandal when he went to Harvard and essentially said, not, you know, I'm not going to do that. And he was quite strong in his criticism of the established churches. But then they went out with a great deal of fervor to live, I don't know, I would use the word religious, but a lot of people don't like it. So they would call it today spiritual lives. And I think that they're a good guide. And so that's pretty much what I do. What they did, like Thoreau, but also Emerson, went into nature. And nature was their first movement into a new way of being religious or spiritual, was to not go to church, but go into nature. And Thoreau is amazingly specific and energetic in his way of doing that, that he went into nature with a great deal of gusto and got to know nature very well. But he went there not as a scientist to study it, but as someone who wanted to find meaning in his life. And that's why he went into nature, to find meaning. And he found it. He found his life there. And so that's something that we could all notice, that we're looking for some way to develop a, get close to our soul in a spiritual way, maybe. The first step would be to go into the natural world.
And that, assumably, is to feel the energy that comes through just by putting your back against a tree or sitting on the ground. To feel the energy, but also perhaps to contemplate on nature itself. And that reminds me of a very famous talk that the Buddha gave one time where he just held up a flower.
Yeah, that was a very important gesture. And those gestures are really important. So I think that's a that is really, I like to think of that story of the flower as art, that's the role of art to, at least in part, to be able to behold something both meaningful and beautiful and to be inspired by it. Thoreau in particular wanted a community with nature. He wanted really to feel a relative of nature. I was just reading a passage from him this morning where he says that when he is there living next to Walden Pond, he's never alone. He doesn't feel lonely because he has so much around him. And he mentions the trees and the creatures in the water and the plants. So the plant life is really important. But that's something that I don't know if we focus enough on, that, like he says, it's a cure for loneliness to be close to plants. And we usually think we need people. You know, we have to be, that if you're lonely, you need get some people around you, guy, you know, like really. And it's so automatic, but Thoreau said it's a mistake, that we all are already surrounded by beings, and if we knew that, we would never get lonely.
Beautiful. And being a very depthy person, too, sometimes I think us humans, we can live on shallow levels or very deep levels, and sometimes when you're wanting depth and you're in a more, let's just say, shallow or gossipy environment, it's very hard to connect with your fellow human beings. And maybe other mammals or nature bring one into those depths when one can't find it in one's own species.
Yeah, it's very possible that you can surround yourself with people and still be lonely.
Right.
So there has to be some connection to, I think with the plant life and with animal life, you're talking about being in touch with your own deeper roots. Like the medieval philosophers said, we all have a vegetable soul and we have an animal soul and a human soul. And so, being close to the plant life and to animal life is, in a sense, getting close to your own roots.
Why plant medicines also really work for us, perhaps, and why, again, cats and dogs can be so healing in different home environments. And today also there is a rise of loneliness and an increase in loneliness and anxiety and depression. Do you correlate that to the movement towards cities and more concrete, even though obviously cities have, you know, parks and, but we can't see stars many times in big cities. You're not connected to the night sky. You can't track, astrologically. So do you see a correlation there perhaps with where we are right now?
I don't know. I guess to some extent I do, but not entirely. I think that you can have a very rich life in a city. I don't want to romanticize nature and say we have to leave the city and go into the natural world. But on the other hand, if you do live in a city, I think it's very wise to make excursions into nature regularly. You know, to make a part of that's one easy way to solve that problem. If you live in the city, go into nature. If you live in nature, I live in nature right now. I'm in the middle of a forest, and I like to have my excursions into cities. So I think it's a good idea to have both, but you do it thoughtfully and on your own rhythm, whatever works for you. But thinking it through so it isn't just unconscious.
Yes, the both and, because in cities we also, they're hubs of art and music and, right? And that also, we, when we think of soulful, right? If we use the word soulful, often you think of, or I do anyway, think of music or collections of beautiful pieces of art.
Or just people on the streets and walking the streets. That's what I do. Yeah. Dublin, Ireland is my city pretty much. That's where I go. And I've walked the streets of Dublin for I don't know how many years. I started when I was 19 years old doing that. And so that gives a lot to me. But I don't live there. I would never want to live there and do that all the time. But I love to leave home in my beautiful natural environment and go to Dublin, or maybe go to New York or Boston, or, you know, some other city. I don't travel as much as I used to, but now to me, those are the places that I go. London, Dublin, New York, and Boston, pretty much for city life. And then if I do that once a year, I'm happy staying at home where all I have are animals around me.
Yeah, animals in the deep forest sounds wonderful. So, yes, the out and the in. I do believe earlier you said breath.
Yes.
So the inspiration, I don't know if you have a breathwork practice or I'm a big yogi, so pranayama has been a big part of my life. When you say breath, is it being mindful and conscious of your breath or?
That's a big question for me. I spent my early life as a Catholic monk for 13 years. And I really enjoyed that. And I did the whole thing. I did it so well, really, and loved it. But I left it. And when I left it to try to, my goal has been, my work has been to find a way to do what I did as a monk, but do it in a kind of an ordinary way. So I don't do spiritual practices. I did for years, but I don't do them now. I don't breathe in any mindful way. I don't use the word mindful myself. So I don't do that. And what I do is I try to live a life that where the world around me, especially this natural world, and the inspirations that come from within me give me my structures, and I don't any longer look for anything outside of that.
And the listening, when I hear you speak on other podcasts and know a little bit about your life story, like you're saying, you went actually very early on into a monastery, right? Were you 13? Yeah, you were 13 to 26, very, very early days. But there was something that prompted you to go. There was something that prompted you to leave. Yes. So perhaps you could share with us a little bit more of what does it feel like? Is it visceral? Is it a angelic voice in the head? How that guidance, how has it spoken to you, and how do you follow it?
Well, it's a really good question. It's one I think about a lot and want to write about more. When I was 13, I was just overwhelmed by a desire to do what I saw other people I admired do. I was close to the Catholic priests and nuns that were in my school and church, and the young men who went off to join them. They were really great people, and I thought if these wonderful young men were doing that, I wanted to be part of it. I was really fired up from within myself. I couldn't say it wasn't anything particular. It was very strong. It was almost like being in love, you know, it's just there, and it's very strong and dynamic, kind of wild and crazy because of how strong it is, how strong the impulse is. And my parents wisely asked me to wait till I left high school, but I didn't want to do that. I was too fired up for it. And I look back on it now, and I wish I didn't have to do that because I left my family, which is a wonderful, warm family that I was with, beautiful family. And that was forever, really. You know, I mean, once you leave, then you leave. And on the other hand, my family was in a kind of a small world. My dad was a plumber, and we lived in a working class neighborhood. And just going away, I think the first day I left home, the world opened up to me. The world of learning and so much opened up to me. And I still, I still benefit from all the things that happened to me in those years when I was away from home. So it's hard to know. It's hard for me to know what to say about it, good or bad, but it was certainly a good thing for me to do, I think, ultimately.
And it sounds like it was a feeling, it was a calling, but it was a calling of love.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It was a love for something, great desire.
Yes. And is the heart, I mean, just as you say that, I can feel my whole heart center warming and expanding. Is there something more to say around these callings and or soulfulness and the heart center?
Well, I just finished reading for about the 50th time James Hillman's essay called The Thought of the Heart, where he talks about thinking from the heart and what that's like. And he uses the image of a lion for it. He takes it from alchemy, the image of the lion and the heart, the lion heart, you know, lion-hearted and all that. And he's saying, you know, that when you think from, when you get a thought from the heart, it is full of energy, strength, longing. It's a very, very big thing. And, you know, it's, you don't resist it easily. And I couldn't resist that at all. And so to me, it wasn't a matter of making a choice. I was just overwhelmed by my heart opened up to that possibility.
It's interesting, the turn of phrase. Hillman, genius when it comes to turn of phrases, for sure. But thought in the heart. And again, this will just be semantics. But inspiration or intuition or, again, that sort of divine conversation, as opposed to what I think of the word thoughts, it's more sort of left hemispheric or something within a complex that sort of stirs around, versus when I think of the heart, I think of, inspiration or perhaps the word intuition. Does that resonate with you at all?
Well, it does, but that's also close to me because I've written a lot of books in the past part of my life, and I'm not writing them from my mind, really. I'm not. I'm writing them from my heart. There's no question. Sometimes I think that I'm writing them as a therapist. That's my writing. It's not writing from my mind. You know, a lot of people do write from their minds, and they have a lot of ideas that you know are coming from that higher place. I have done a lot of study in my life, but I filter it all through my heart, really. And I think I write all these books that way. I'm interested in the beauty that's there. And I think the beauty aspect comes from the heart. I'm always working so hard to get the right words and words that really are worth reading, you know, and not just expressing an idea or a fact. I never write facts anyway. I always tell people I never offer any information. I'm not interested in information. I'm just interested in working an idea and making it something you might love and want to be associated with and maybe make part of your life. So that's what I do. And so that too is from the heart. It's really thinking from the heart because it is a kind of thinking. You don't write books without thinking. But it's at least it's very closely connected to the heart, at least that.
I mean, what comes to me as you're speaking is this, it's a relational aspect in all ways, body, soul, nature, mind, heart. There's a very relational, aspect to what you're sharing.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So I feel very close to my readers and to I do sense a heart relationship with them. And, I think that affects the way I do everything. I worry about them. I worry about my connection. I make a real effort all the time. I'm writing a book right now about Thoreau, not about him, but using his ideas and I'm doing the revising now. I've done the rough draft and I'm doing the revising. And I like it so much because there's even more heart in this revision than there is in the first writing. It's trying to shape it and it's like giving it a body. It's giving that writing a more beautiful body and paying attention to the body of the writing as it develops now. Now I can shape it and make it something worth reading.
Beautiful. And I do want to come back to Thoreau, because I think he's also inspirational around social justice aspects, which is very important also for us today. Sticking with this relational aspect, James Hillman, a big influence of yours, C.G. Jung, big influence. One of the core principles of Jungian depth psychology, this religious function of the psyche, relatable ways of engaging with meaning and purpose. Is there anything you have to share around that? I know you're not a Orthodox Jungian, and I happen to be right in that camp with you. We're both depth psychologists, but we've also been deeply influenced, certainly. Well, yeah. Yeah, tremendously, right. I mean, when you think of Jung, right, also the heart just expands, knowing the body of work he left us all. And that, yes, in his articulation of the religious function of the psyche, is there any wisdom or anything else you have to share around that?
Well, maybe if I can answer that indirectly. A couple of years ago now, I guess, I published an article called Jung the Magus, Jung the Magician. And magus is I use a Latin pronunciation of that word, magus, meaning like the magi, you know, the magus, the magician. There's a whole history of magic in throughout the world, but it's including the European tradition. And I know that pretty well. I've worked a lot on it. And I feel that Jung had a part of him that was a psychiatrist and was very worried about being right. And worrying about being right, but also sounding like a really grounded person. And there was a side to him that didn't worry about it at all and was a magus. He was a magician who was interested in, you know, in carving stones that had a magical purpose. Those stones he carved were there to bring something to his life and to the lives of people around him. And his Red Book is a piece of magic. You know, it's a magical production. Now, that side of Jung, I think, is much more, infinitely more interesting to me than his theoretical side. And so I could care less about defining the anima or the shadow, but I love exploring what he did with stones. And what he did with paint and oil and making books and all that kind of thing. He was a magician. And magic, people don't understand that these days, but magic is really a part of religion. It's not against religion, not the kind of magic that Jung was caught up in. And so he makes a Red Book that's a ritual book. It's a ritual book, and it's one that he even makes to look like a holy book. And that's, I think, where that religious element comes in. It's not, certainly not a belief system or an organization that you belong to. It's closer to the magical realm where you live in the realm of mystery and you have methods, upaya, methods of being able to, relate to those mysteries. That's what that's how I define religion, the ways that we relate to the mysteries. And that's what Jung does. And I think that's where he shows, maybe he does try to explore it a bit in his theory, but I think he shows it in his life how to do it.
Yes, right. Beautiful example. Exemplary life of lived, soul lived, or the deep listening. I often today sub out spiritual function of the psyche because religion, the word religion, religious, does tend to put people on edge. today, I think, especially given actually what's happened within the Catholic Church, or again, right out your back door in Boston, right? They opened up this, the Boston Globe, the research they did on the local diocese and what was happening in the Catholic Church. So there's been a lot of harm done. It's not just Catholicism. So I don't want to, you know, But it's that idea that, again, people are leaving religions. They're not affiliated anymore. They don't necessarily have religious practices. But yes, this connection to meaning and purpose. And when you say magic, it also reminds me of Jung's connection to mysterious phenomena, so to speak, or his cousin, right, was a medium. His mother had intuitive, if not psychic, gifts. Jung's theory, if you will, or concept of synchronicity enfolds his whole life and everything that he had experienced early on. So when you say magic, that's what comes forward for me as well, this idea that Jung was deeply relating to or embodying his interconnection with multidimensional aspects of reality.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, everyone has a different way, a different language for it. I think that Jung was a theologian, for one thing. He could speak intelligently, write intelligently about religious matters in different traditions. He was, you know, so well read and so knowledgeable about so many things, that he could do that. And I think when he uses the word religion, he means it in such a profound way that it's something that today is probably hard to grasp, given what, like, as you were saying, the way the word is used today. For myself, I have to say, you know, I have a degree in religious studies. I'm not giving that up. I redefine religion. I don't get rid of it. So that's what I do on all my work. And I know I end up in trouble because I use the word and people get all upset. Well, you know, I can't help that. It's the only way I can see it. So I see religion as a good thing. It's a way of relating concretely to the mysteries that are around us, all around us. And there's so many things that are, so many ways of doing that. And I think we need that so badly today. We need a religious sense. I don't think the word spiritual quite does it for what we need there. So I don't know what to do. We're in between time, they're trying to figure it out, but I just go along making a few mistakes and then still trying to find the language that works for me.
Sure, because language is a pointer, ultimately, right? I mean, this is what we're pointing to, I think, in this conversation. It's a lived experience that perhaps can pop through language, but it's actually something that's happening more prior to language, perhaps, or, you know, the language is more of the perfume of the essence, the beingness, the experiential aspects that are happening underneath the language.
Oh, yeah, sure. I guess so. Yeah, they are certainly, perfume's a nice image. It's part of it, but it's kind of what's that word? It's like an emanation of the experience, an emanation of it. And so you want your language to be close to the experience. But yet that's why I say, for me, my whole life is about choosing the right words. I mean, that's what I do.
Yeah, the play of choosing those words. In religions, all across the board, even though you say your practices are different today than they were, I know you've recently written a book, The Eloquence of Silence.
Mm-hmm.
Observing silence can be a practice, centering prayer. Tell us more about silence and perhaps emptiness as well, and how the mystery and this life movement relates both to silence and emptiness.
Yeah. Well, all of my career, I can't remember where I first heard the idea of emptiness. I get it mainly from Zen Buddhism, probably, because I've studied Zen for a long time and have had a lot of Zen friends affecting me. And the idea of emptiness, which they call shunyata in India, I understand, doesn't mean that something is void, that it doesn't have any substance to it. What it means is that whatever we do and whoever we are, whatever it is, whatever we use, whatever things are around us, we are not attached to. We don't have to accomplish anything through them. We don't have to work too hard about anything we do. We don't have to accept any fear, any praise. We don't have to accept criticism. It's all empty. From a certain point of view, all of that is, in a sense, irrelevant. There's a way in which, that's not a bad word for emptiness, it's irrelevant. And I know it may seem not appreciative to put it that way, but it's a quality, it's a virtue, really, of being able to do whatever you have to do in your life and not have to accomplish anything or take credit for it or worry about your mistakes. I think that I know from as a therapist that when people worry about their mistakes, it's no different from taking credit. It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. So you might learn emptiness that way, that you don't need to do anything. Now, what I do with emptiness, I don't make it absolute. I mean, I don't have to live it absolutely. I do my best. So if I have an opportunity to be, celebrated or praised for something that I have done, I may just soften that whole thing and find ways to make it less significant, but not necessarily to deny it or avoid it. So the emptiness, to me, is a quality of living. It reminds me of taking vows when I was a monk. I took a vow of poverty, meaning that we shared everything in common. And that was a wonderful thing to do, to live all those years with owning nothing and sharing everything, every single thing, the most common things, and not feeling ownership at all, really created community. Similar to me, that poverty was very similar to emptiness. So I don't have to be so worried about money and having to have things. I feel, I put this in that book, I think, that as a father, I feel that I'm very happy to have my children have things and I don't need anything. You know, like I'm happy to have them have something. And if anyone's going to spend some money, I'd much rather have them get what they need than for me. It just, I don't know, it's no big sacrifice. It's just how I feel. I take so much joy out of seeing the kids really have a great time, and my wife as well, to be enriched by something. So I prefer that. I prefer to have that vow of poverty around, which is a form of emptiness.
The flow also comes back to me as you're describing that. It's just a movement without a binding, without a holding on. It allows the energy to keep moving and not get bound or stuck somewhere, whether you call it inside the ego or inside a certain thought form or a grasping onto or a particular level of materialism. It allows flow to come forth.
I think you're right. Absolutely. It's a movement. It's a movement. And you allow that movement to keep going. You don't get stuck anywhere. You don't try to stop it so you can manipulate it somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. As a longtime yogi, the Upanishadic tradition has long influenced me. And the Upanishads, of course, there's no names There's no names. It was knowledge or seeing, perception that was just, it just flowed through, and it was brought forth, and it's a text that's lived now for a very, very long period of time. But you can't point to one author and say, this was yours. It's a compilation, and again, not signed by anyone. And I think that's a beautiful symbol, if you will, to this flow. What would you say about knowledge? Not that you have to locate it, but in that flow, a flow of knowledge, or and this might also, I don't want to compact too many questions, but you know, inspiration is this idea of the transcendent, perhaps, and the up and out, and the immanence is the down and in. How does the knowledge work relate between the up and out and the down and in? Is the knowledge located anywhere, or where would you say knowledge comes from?
For me, knowledge comes from, oh, wow, it's a difficult question. I think in part, at least, it comes to me mainly from the dead, you know, from people who are no longer alive. And I get this, I don't take this idea. It's one that just seems right to me, and it's just mine. But the last book that Hillman wrote was called Lament of the Dead. And one of the things he said there was that when he writes footnotes, he feels that he's not trying to support his own ideas, but he's trying to honor the dead who wrote on the same topics before him. I like that very much, and I feel it myself. That I feel it very strongly in myself that I owe so much to men and women of the past who devoted their lives to working out certain ideas and certain creative work. And many different ways, artistic or intellectual, different ways, religious, spiritual. And I have been fed by them. So look at the books behind me, you know, I mean, it's like, that those are so important to me because that's my community.
Yeah, the wisdom that they bring forth from their own lives. I have to say, it does sound like also, though, you get wisdom from your heart, that it's kind of like a both and. Like you're reading the books for inspiration, but it also sounds that there's wisdom from your embodied lived experience as well.
Oh, yes, that's there too. I think the strongest source for me is, yeah, a kind of inspiration. I'm very taken with the idea of the daimon or the muse or the, and all these different words, orenda. There are so many words used for being inspired and being empowered in invisible ways. I'm very devoted to those ideas. So I am, I really pay attention to my impulses, what the daimon wants me to do. And, even in very tiny things or in big things. And I've just always been that way, even before I knew what those words were.
Yes. And I would say there might be many people watching or listening to this who might not know what that word is. Can you define it?
A daimon?
For us? Yes.
It's a Greek word that refers originally to the Trojan War. We get it from the Iliad, where the soldiers were fighting the war, and these not gods, once in a while gods, but these spirits would appear to be like angels, appear to them and give them courage for what they were doing, and hope. And they were called daimon when they didn't have a proper name. They were called the daimon. And this was picked up throughout history. Various people throughout history have used. Jung himself wrote a lot about daimon. Hillman wrote a lot about it. W.B. Yeats was dedicated to the idea of the daimon. There are just a lot of, I think Virginia Woolf really had a strong feeling of daimon. And so what you do is you live your life more like obedience rather than decision. you obey the inspirations that you sense. And sometimes in the world, there's a signal that you should now make a change in your life. And so you obey the daimonic voice coming from somebody else. Maybe I can give you an example because I always use it. When I was teaching at the university, I loved teaching. That's all I wanted to do, and I wanted to spend the rest of my life. And one day, the chair of my department called me in and said, "We're not going to give you tenure. You know, you can't teach here anymore." And I just felt like everything just in that second fell out. I had nothing. I had nothing. That was my whole life. And he said, "You can appeal this if you like." And I thought to myself, "I can't appeal this. You're the daimon speaking. You don't appeal the daimonic or angelic voice. This is the angel Gabriel here giving a message. And my job is to listen to it and change my course, you know, change the course of my life. That's what I'm doing in this second. I don't have to think about it, and I'm certainly not going to appeal it." So that's daimonic living. It's like you hear a voice, even sometimes someone else's voice. Like this was a person speaking, but I knew that he was speaking in the place of an angel, like an angel or a daimon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I had to obey it and immediately change my direction.
How many years before writing Care of the Soul was that experience?
Let's see. It was about probably 12 years.
12 years before. Mm-hmm. When you speak of daimon also, I'm reminded of James Hillman's The Soul's Code and this idea that the oak is in the acorn and the environment and the messages that the environment brings forward to, you know, here's the acorn, the seed that's holding all the potential, the coded potential in that seed. So here we are back to this idea of environment again, listening. There's so many ways I think we could describe that environment, whether it's going to nature to listen or sitting in silence or the emptiness. But environment really is an important factor to the soul's code or the daimon or the unfolding of life in a feeling that is feels like it's in alignment.
Yes, well, that's true if the world in which you live is alive and if it has voice and if it speaks and if it has personality, all these things. And here we get to the point that we were discussing quite a while ago, that what's wrong with our world that people are so lonely and having trouble. So what's wrong with it is that we have allowed our whole world to be dead. We imagine it as lifeless, that we can bring our microscopes and our instruments to study it, but it is dead. It has no soul. It has no principle of life. It has no intention. You know, it's just there, and we can't relate to it. We can only operate on it and do things with it and exploit it. I think that's what's killing us as a people. Seeing that the world around us is dead, how can you live then? Because you have no guidance, you have no support. You know, you can't walk in the woods and feel that you really are, really know that you're in a community with the trees and the plants. You can't know that if your scientific worldview objectifies that world and makes it lifeless. So that, I think, is one of our huge problems. Mm. If you have that world alive, you can listen to it every day, and you're not going to be lost because you'll get guidance without any problem.
Yes, like the re-enchantment. We need re-enchantment. Yes. For sure. I mean, science has helped us in many ways. It's not that we want to excise it completely. It has its place. But when anything becomes too prominent, then we're in a form of rigidity again. We're not in that flow. So science is, again, it adds, it's additive. But if it takes up too much space, it becomes noise. And then there's not enough enchantment or... the soul of the world cannot be felt. Maybe we could say that, and therefore we find ourselves polluting our water supply and our environment, and in need of an eco-psychology now to really figure out. So, yeah, how about soul of the world then, anima mundi? Is that a case of us getting in touch with our own inner essence and soul and expanding that out or out in, or again, different strokes for different folks kind of thing, different people?
Well, the problem with going from inner outer is that we probably end up in the realm of projection, which is really one of my bad words, you know, I hope we don't do that, you know, that we see that the world is alive, that it has a soul because we give it to it or we project onto it. That's not the point at all. Just the opposite is that we allow the world to be alive and it projects us, if anything. It gives us our reality and feeds us and supports us and teaches us. I think we learn from the way the nature works how to be human beings. There's so many things, lessons we can learn. That's why I'm writing this work on Thoreau now, because he is so good at pointing out what lessons that I've never heard anywhere else, lessons on how to live that no one else has ever said. They're so weird and so eccentric, but I think so right on, so good. So nature does teach us many things, but it can't teach us if we make it into something that doesn't have any vitality and can't express and doesn't have a soul or doesn't have a mind even. You know, we don't allow that because it seems that's not how we see the world. We see it as dead out there. Everything out there is really an object. So, and it's only the traditional peoples of the world that have been able to live in an animated world. And their lives have been in many ways better than ours because they have had the animated life around them. We have death around us. We've killed it. It's not naturally dead. We've killed it.
Yes. The what comes to me as you say that is the materialism or the consumption, that everything is for our use to consume, right? And of course, it is beautiful to buy flowers or pick flowers and put them in your home. But this idea of allowing nature to grow and be where she is and appreciated on her terms, that it isn't just for human consumption, that deep appreciation of the beingness, the essence of the lived world.
Well, that brings us back to the religion question, because I have some favorite books. One is called The Lives of Indian Images, I think, and the other one is about Japanese temple building. And in both cases, people who are building temples choose, you know, have a ritual when they choose what trees to use to build their building. And they have rituals at every step along the way to make sacred everything they're doing. So they are not just exploiting that stuff. They are actually, because of their religious vision, they can get over that situation where you can not exploit, but you can use the materials of the natural world for your own, like building your home or whatever, making a nice car. You can do all that. But we could do it in a way that wasn't so secular, and I think our souls would benefit much more.
Yes, yes. Imagine if soul was taken into consideration with every step that we take, our world would be looking quite different. But also, religious wars are still raging today and have long been fought. So it is interesting that there isn't harmony that can be found across religious traditions.
What you find, though, I think, is that when there are these wars, religious wars, it's really ideological rather than spiritual. You know what I mean? People turn their religion into ideology. This is what I believe. This is the way the world is. And if you don't believe that, you must be my enemy. That is ideological. That is not, I don't think that comes from a religious place of honoring the sacredness of the world in which you live.
Right. That's the fascinating part. If religion is about honoring, and certainly about heart or love, there's something that humans haven't been able yet to grapple with or to solve, that it goes into ideology instead of a heart-centeredness where we're relating regardless of the denomination or the tradition.
Yes. So, you know, I spent a good deal of time, not, I don't know, 10 years ago, I guess, going back to my tradition to try to see if I could revivify some of it instead of complaining all the time and saying it should be different. So what I did, I translated the Gospels from Greek and wrote commentaries on them that I thought, from my point of view, brought life into them and made them sacred, so that they were not ideological, that they couldn't be that way. And I found, as when I was doing that, that it was so interesting to me that the translations of those sacred texts that people are reading are, it's like they have an underlying materialism in them and ideology in them. The words are right there, the sacred words are right there, and then the translators don't translate them that way because they're coming from this different philosophy, you know, that where everything is heroic and ideological, and so they don't even translate the words in a sacred manner. I think that's the difference. Now, I know that my work in that area, you know, hasn't accomplished anything. Nobody's read those translations, but I wanted to, at least for myself, to do it, to show that there's a way to bring life into these religious traditions, and we don't have to keep them and let them keep falling apart and becoming more and more dead.
Interesting. Again, it reminds me of yoga, a long-term tradition, and it definitely has sacred texts, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali in particular, but it's well known that it can't be about reading the text and hanging on to what the text is saying, that it has to drop into the lived experience of being. Ultimately, the text, I don't want to say it means nothing, because it does mean so much, and it guides a lot of people, but it also clearly points to the fact that it is not about this text. It is about the lived experience of yoga in your body, in the world.
Yeah, it's very similar. I think it's happening all over. I don't know if you know Stephen Batchelor. Stephen Batchelor's done a lot of work in trying to revive some of the language around Buddhist yogic practices. He and I had a conversation where we realized we were both doing something very similar. I was doing it with the Christian materials, and he was doing it with the Buddhist materials.
Yeah, there's a confluence for sure, right? All roads lead to Rome in some sense. That's the fascinating part about why we have these ideologies and these wars, when in fact the depth of the teachings, they really all are pointing to a deep lived experience, you know. Yeah. Okay, well, before we wrap up here, Thomas, are there any words to leave us with around Thoreau and his ideas on social justice? Again, the Bhagavad Gita is going to be one of my favorite texts, and it's a text about social justice. It's about yoga and union and the teachings of yoga, which have to do with service, the heart, knowledge, but also showing up at the period of time in which you're born and engaging, because social justice is important, and morality and ethics. I know this is a big topic. We could probably do a whole episode on that. But if you have anything to share around either those ideas of Thoreau's or just your own.
Well, what I'm seeing in Thoreau, which I appreciate, I guess it's close to my own feeling about it, is that the main thrust of his life and what he was doing was to, he wanted to find out how to live, himself as an individual. What did he have to do in his life? And then how to be in the world. And he had this intuition that the way to do that was to go into the natural world and learn as much about it as he possibly could. But I have an essay where he says, don't bring your botany, he says, when you go into the forest. So he doesn't want you to go in to study it like a scholar would study it or a scientist would study it. He wants you to go in and encounter it, encounter that world, and be affected by it, be affected by that world. He has all kinds of lessons on how to do that. And at the same time, I mean, he was doing that. That was primarily what, where his focus was, but almost just as part of the rest of life, he was helping people constantly coming up in the Underground Railroad of slaves coming up from the South, helping them get to Canada. And he and his family were putting them in his house. These people in his house, they had a special place for the Underground Railroad in their own home. And when necessary, he would give talks on it, and he would invite the most radical radical abolitionist with him to come to Concord and to speak. And at the end, he was a strong advocate of John Brown, who was a radical abolitionist trying to get rid of slavery. So social justice was just part of his life. But it wasn't the core. And I mean, it wasn't the thing that, if anything, it came out of his relationship to the natural world. To which I think he would say, what I have to do is hoe my beans. I have to get out there and plant them and take care of them and make them grow. And I have to go into my pond and I have to swim in it every day. That's my sacrament, he said. That's my sacrament. So he was making sacred his life. And I think that his social justice then just came out of that as naturally as can be. And he didn't trumpet his social justice. He didn't make any big deal of it. He just did it. I don't even know if people knew how much he was doing for social justice. And then, you know, he didn't pay his taxes once and he went to jail overnight. And people made a big deal of that. But I don't think that's really the real focus of his social justice. I don't think civil disobedience is the main thing. I think his work with the Underground Railroad really is what shows his entirely, you know, fierce dedication to social justice. But it was rooted in his close intimacy with the natural world.
Thank you so much for sharing his wisdom, all your wisdom, the ancestors speaking. yeah, beautiful. Any final words you would like to leave the New Thinking Aloud community with today?
There is a great, great desire and hunger for a deeper understanding of both psyche and spirit. Deep, deep hunger for it. And, it's just look at the United States today, the religious situation where people are with the religious ideas, it's not a good scene. Whether it's whatever side it's on, traditional or people exploring new things. So I just feel that, just talking for myself, that I keep trying very hard myself to stay on a track that is solid and has a good backing in history and with good people with really good imaginations and minds and hearts, and hoping that, and I really believe actually that if we stay with this, that we will become more sophisticated than we have been in the recent few decades. And we might be able to see more clearly what's going on and devote ourselves to things that are worthy of our attention. There's too much wasted effort, I think, going into things that are not worthy of our attention simply because we can't discern, we can't decide, we can't figure it out.
Well, I so appreciate your vision and the call for revivification of the ancestors or Plato or the lineage that we come from and how soul has been spoken about and cared for. And deep appreciation for everything that you've brought to us today, Thomas, and all of the work that you've given the world around care of the soul. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leanne. We couldn't have this conversation without your background and brilliance, so thank you very much.
Thank you. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we're here, in community, exploring our common unity.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.